she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Online on Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. If you're looking for some great information, check out the thinklinkstore.com. That should make it pretty easy. And join me for a really exciting conversation today. So I want to talk a little bit about, well, there's a couple of things. First of all, some very big news this week. We have finally, in this country, crossed a major threshold. We have now created, officially, the same number of jobs that was lost in the Great Recession. If you think about that mountain that we have climbed, there were like 8 million jobs that just disappeared, and now 8 million something people have been hired since the end of the Great Recession. So we have now gotten all the way back to zero. The problem is that the same zero isn't really, well, first, we've missed out on all these years of growth, which is really awful. Job creation is tepid at best. I know we had a pretty good report, but 192,000 jobs is not, you know, what I would call just an amazing recovery. I mean, we are slowly, slowly scraping by. The new Fed president, Janet Yellen, has said that she would like very much to focus on job creation in this country. I'm not sure what the Fed is going to be able to do for job creation, since we've seen extra low interest rates now for all of these years, and jobs have just only sort of been tepidly recovering. But it's psychologically an interesting place. It's really interesting that we're finally... Now, remember, the recession officially ended in 2009. 5 years later, we're almost exactly at 5 years, because I think it was June of 2009 that the recession was officially called over. And here we are in 2014, just a month or two shy of 5 years. And we're finally crossing back to where we were for all those jobs that were lost. Just amazing. Do you remember how bad it actually got? I would come in on a Sunday morning and we would talk about how the latest numbers showed that 750,000 jobs were lost in a month, or 800,000 in 1 month. It was just crazy, crazy numbers. And now we've reversed it, and we're seeing job growth. And, of course, everybody every month calls, oh, well, we're back now because the number of first-time unemployed is below 300,000 or it's below 400,000. It's just slow and steady. But this is a milestone, and we should celebrate milestones. For everybody who's gotten a job, that's fantastic. The problem is a lot of the job creation is still part-time. And if you look at that U6 number, the U6 number is kind of the total number of unemployment. Our official unemployment number is somewhere around 6.7%. But if you look at the U6, which includes part-time people who'd rather be full-time, it includes people thrown up their hands and gone off to go back to school or stay at home or be a parent, a stay-at-home parent, that number ticked up this last month, and it's now at 12.7%. And as Janet Yellen talked about this week in her comments, this still feels like a recession to a lot of people. It absolutely feels like a recession to a lot of people, and that cannot be lost. That point that people are still out there hurting, they may have jobs, they're making less than they were, they may want a full-time job, they can only get part-time. Hordes of our young people in their early 20s have moved home because if they have been lucky enough to find a job, that they can't make enough at that job to actually pay for the expenses of life. Right? Let alone a mortgage, just the rent, and car payments, school loans, credit card debt, all the other things, the other pieces of life that they have added in profoundly have not worked out to satisfaction. And so they found themselves living at home with mom and dad, which isn't so bad, right? This generation of millennials, digital kids, they feel very much more connected to their parents. And I, as a parent of two digital millennials, I'm very happy about that. So it's interesting to kind of think about that employment number and what it really means when you look over time at what was going on. When I look at USA Today has a terrific chart up online, which I will tweet out just a few minutes, where it looks at jobs gains and losses, and the green are jobs that we're creating. And there was a month where I want to say it was early in 2010, May 10th of 2010. So 4 years ago, that we had a month over month change of 516,000 jobs created. That was a good month. Compare that to the very worst month, which was March of 2009, where we lost 826,000 jobs in a month. Or we compare that to January of 2009, where we lost 798,000 jobs in a month. And so you look at the big red blob and you start to realize how much the economy compressed. And you look at what's happened since, and aside from that one month in 2010, and there have been a couple of other spikes. There was a spike in January 2012 of 360,000 jobs, and there was a little baby spike in February of 2013 of 280,000 jobs created. When you look, though, at the rest of it, the green lines are all pretty similar. So we're not seeing the kind of spikes that we saw even in 2004 and 2005 when you get 350,000 jobs created in a month. It's just not happening. It's not happening in any way that we have seen before or that we would expect to see. Over the last couple of weeks, I've been doing some traveling here and in Mexico. In fact, we went down to Oaxaca, Mexico, Oaxaca City. And many of you may know that my husband Sam was born and raised there. His parents are American, but they were transferred down, and he and his family lived in Mexico City for 25 years. And one of the places that he visited as a young teenager, was Oaxaca City with his parents. And so we decided to go and take our son, Michael, for his spring break and drive around and see some of the small towns where things are still made exactly the way they were made, probably 100 years ago. There are these small towns, and everybody in the town weaves rugs. And in this town over there, they breed goats. And in this town over here, they make pottery. And in this town over here, they do whatever. And so everybody, every town grows its own trade, so to speak. And there's apprenticeships. And, you know, these people over here are wood carvers, and they do some incredible paintings. Just amazing stuff. So we're down there, we're driving around, and we notice that there's, towns look like they're half-built, right? And so our driver, who's a tour guide down there that we met, was telling us about how before the recession in the United States, that there was a lot of building going on. There was a lot of money that flows from the United States down to Mexico and all of Latin America. And in some ways, it's become this tremendous shadow economy. And he said, look, you can see the houses that have thatched roofs and no water and no electricity and are just kind of very unimproved. He's like, those people don't have any people in America who are sending the money. Then the one next door is like a three-story beautiful house. These people have families in America sending money back. And so we said to him, how has it changed? And he said, well, since the recession, we've had a recession here in Oaxaca as well, and fewer tourists are coming down, and fewer people are sending money back. And you can see that the buildings, a lot of them are just kind of, they're half finished or quarter finished or partially finished, because these families are building their houses sort of a bag of cement at a time. And it was just really interesting to just see in real life how a deep recession in the United States affects people all over the world. We're such a melting pot in this country that the economy that we've created is an economy that flows all over the world. And so when we don't do well, they don't do well. And, and it's families sending money back to families. And it's just sort of amazing. So kind of think about our economy in a little bit of a different way, where we think about the, you know, our American brethren, right, who are up here and they're looking for work, and then their immediate families live, they help them as well. And so one of the things that we saw in terms of housing in the Great Recession that has not reversed itself yet, right, this is also very slow, is household formation. The number of people, because, again, young kids are living at home with their parents, but also multi-generations of families have moved back in together to save money. And so one of the things that we noticed back 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago when I was working with some of the realtors in Atlanta and in some other metropolitan areas that were severely, severely hit in the recession, is that 4, 5, and 6-bedroom homes had become premium, because you could have 2 or 3 families living together in a 6-bedroom house, or a 4 or 5-bedroom house, as opposed to a 1, 2, or 3-bedroom house or condo. And so larger houses allowed more family income to live together, and you haven't seen that break apart yet. And those houses continue to be in demand. And so once you see household formation start to come back, you'll know that the job creation thing is really happening at a level that's sustainable for many families. And it's just interesting to see how times are changing. 404-872-0750 is our number here at the station, or 1-800-WSB-TALK if you'd like me to pick up the cost of your call. Actually, it won't be me. It'll be my boss, Pete. But we're happy to pay for that. If you've got a question for me, money, real estate, I can do my best at taxes. Although the only thing I want to warn you about is that there is a big scam right now, an email scam focused on tax filings. And I'll talk about that in just a minute coming up next. I am Elyse Glink. This is the Elyse Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
News 95 at AM 750 WSB keeps you covered with breaking news, weather, and traffic all weekend. This is Scott Slade. Join us early. Atlanta's morning news begins at 4:30 Monday with traffic updates every 6 minutes of what could be a wet morning drive on WSB.
7 lonely days and a dozen towns ago, I reached out one night and you were gone.
Welcome back, everybody. It is 24 minutes past the hour on the Elyse Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. Lines are open, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, at Glink, at GLINK. And congratulations to Crystal and everybody who's going for Kentucky. Big win last night. That's why we were playing, I was just told, Kentucky music today. I said, oh, does that mean bluegrass? And Crystal says, no, it doesn't mean bluegrass. I love bluegrass, though. All right, coming up after the break, there's been a brand new study that shows from, who did this study? I think this one is Zillow. I'm going to go with Zillow. New data shows that nationally, more than one-third of homes for sale are currently unaffordable to buyers who are searching for them. This goes into, a couple of weeks ago, you'll remember, I asked you, why aren't you buying? I had been giving I had been giving a speech out east in Boston for the New England Association of Realtors, and Lawrence Yun, who is the senior vice president and chief economist for the National Association of Realtors, was saying that, you know, here's a list of reasons that people aren't buying. And I just thought there were more reasons than that. So I opened up the phone lines, and we just got loads and loads of calls. I said, why aren't you buying? And people called in and said, I'm not buying because I can't find anything to buy. That lower priced cash offers are being accepted over my higher priced offer with a mortgage, even when I'm pre-approved. I have too much debt. I can't find anything I like. I mean, there were just 7, 8, 9, 10 different reasons for why people weren't able to buy. Well, one of the reasons that I've been worried about is the rise of unaffordability of homes. Home prices have been going up, and mortgage interest rates are going up, and that is a combination that together makes homes very unaffordable. So I was wondering how Atlanta would have played in that. And the truth is, it is not. It's an unaffordable neighborhood, and I'll discuss why. But it is by no means the least affordable neighborhood on the market. Believe it or not, Miami right now, Miami is one of the most unaffordable markets in the country, maybe even the most affordable. So I thought we would talk a little bit about that when we come back. And as I promised, I did want to also talk a little bit about this email scam. So the phishing email appears to be from the IRS. And remember, we're just a little bit now in front of tax day, right? It's a week from Tuesday. It includes a bogus case number, tells you that your 2013 income is flagged for review due to a document processing error. And it looks like it's coming from the IRS, from the Taxpayer Advocacy Service. This is a scam because the IRS will never email you or call you for an initial contact about your tax return. If they need to talk to you, they send you a letter through the mail with all the information you need. Now, Georgia does sometimes contact you with email, and that can be extraordinarily confusing. But if you are getting emails from the IRS and even Georgia, hang it, delete them, and then if you want to, you can contact them on the other side to see if there's anything that they need. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. We are talking about real estate and mortgages here on the Elise Klink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time on WSB.
Depend on us for breaking news, weather, and traffic updates all weekend. In Atlanta's morning news, listen early for weather and traffic updates every 6 minutes. A heavy cold rain will start the week. And Kirk Mellish's five-day forecast on WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Klink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. Our number, lines are open. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. If I can help, if I'm be of service in some way, pick up the phone, give me a call. Or you can tweet at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. So what is affordable for you? The whole idea of affordability, which is so interesting, that lenders have decided affordability truly for a conventional loan is no more than 28% of your gross monthly income on your mortgage, taxes, real estate taxes, and insurance. On the other hand, if you want to have, if you have no other debt, they'll allow you to spend up to 36% on total debt. A third of your take-home pay, which translates once you take out all the other stuff into maybe half or 55% of your take-home pay. And this is considered to be perfectly affordable. Perfectly affordable. Maybe not recommended, but perfectly affordable. If you're getting an FHA loan, you can go up to 43% of your gross monthly income, up to 43%, which feels like 60% of your take-home pay. That's considered affordable. That's why it's so stunning that according to the latest survey from Zillow, one-third of homes for sale are unaffordable by historical standards. Right? So more than half of the homes that are currently on the market in seven major metro areas are currently unaffordable. Among 35 of the largest metro areas nationwide, more than half of the homes listed for sale are unaffordable. And this includes Miami, Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco, Denver, very surprised about Denver, San Jose, Portland, Oregon. That is just shocking. What is in Atlanta? In Atlanta, we have a median household income of $57,797, and we have the average home value index at $136,400. And so 37.4% of homes in the market are unaffordable by historic standards. And when you look at the current percentage of monthly income devoted to mortgage payments on that median price home, it's only 11%, right? And normally that can float up to 19%. But where the homes are priced right now, the ones that have come back in the market, it is so expensive that you would be spending way more than what you should be. And I've just given you what those statistics are. There is a formula. Now, Chicago is relatively inexpensive at the moment. So the median household income is $61,000 and change. The value index of homes that are on the market, $177,000, only 31%, a little bit below normal, is unaffordable to people who are looking for it. So when you start to think about what people earn and what the housing prices are, you start to understand that there is a relationship between what people are earning. D.C., the median income is $91,000. It's a lot of government people. The median price of homes that are on the market, $343,000, and 40% are unaffordable. So what's affordable to you? And how do you feel about it? And what's going on in your neighborhood? So how do these homes start rising in price? So again, what's really interesting, so my son Michael and I were having this conversation about statistics in general. And statistics can be manipulated. It's like saying, well, the sky is blue. Okay, sometimes the sky is blue. And you could say that when the sun is in the sky is blue. But it's not always true, right? There are phenomena that change the color of the sky. And so that's how statistics work, right? You think that you are dealing in a fact-based world, but you're not always doing that, right? That's just sort of how math goes and the interpretation of math. So what would change a price of a home for sale? Well, a lot of it reflects what's going on in that neighborhood, right? So if you've been in a neighborhood with a huge amount of foreclosures, and we've had tons of calls from people over the last, I don't know, 6-8 months, whose neighborhoods are still in deep trouble because of the foreclosures that are there. And this is an area that investors haven't gone into, haven't bought up homes by the dozens, aren't fighting with people to buy these homes. So when you're in a neighborhood like that, you're not actually seeing home prices rise, right? And so when people put their homes in the market, it's lower, right? Because you're still competing against foreclosures that are for sale. Well, in neighborhoods where all of those foreclosures, the houses that were for sale for $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 have all come off the market. And now the next lowest priced homes are, say, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. Then those come off the market. Then $50,000, $60,000, $70,000. Those come off the market. Well, home prices rise pretty quickly in those neighborhoods. And so you quickly see, especially with interest rates up a full percentage point from where they were a year ago, those homes would become unaffordable. People just simply can't afford them. So what does that mean for you? Well, if you're selling, not so bad, right? That you may be able to, as long as you're pricing property reasonably and where it should be. Where it should be, meaning competitive with where homes have been listed on the marketplace and what they should cost, right? So if the last home in the neighborhood sold for $150,000, and you price yours at $350,000, you'll be sitting for a while. Heck, you might still sit for a year or two. But if the last home sold was sold at $150,000 and you price yours at $155,000, odds are you'll sell quickly. It's only 2 or 3% higher than where the last home sold. That's a decent enough price range, right? People can be in that price range. And there is an art, absolutely an art, to pricing your home, to understanding what else is out there and then pricing it competitively. Now, how do mortgage interest rates fit into that? Well, when mortgage interest rates are low, people can afford more. So if you're getting a 30-year fixed rate loan for 3.5%, you probably can afford four times your gross income. So if you earn $50,000 a year, I'm just going to make the number super easy for math purposes. $50,000 a year is family income, and mortgage interest rates are 3.5%. A conventional lender will probably let you borrow and spend up to about $200,000 on the home four times. And this is assuming a down payment. At 4.5%, the lender might let you spend less, maybe $180,000. So affordability has just been cut because mortgage interest rates have gone up. So imagine how much more limited affordability is if mortgage interest rates go up and housing prices go up. And that's what's happened over the last year. We've seen housing prices jump up 20% in Atlanta. And again, it's all about what's going on in your block. But over the metro area, we've seen home prices go up as the bottom level's been sucked out and purchased, and sometimes fixed up and spit back, and sometimes just rented to those people who were living in it, and sometimes rented to different people. But that lowest level has been sucked out. So now you've got affordability in a place where it's getting more expensive to buy that home. Is that happening to you? Are you starting to see that happen in your neighborhood? Could you afford the houses in your neighborhood? And what's really interesting about this is how nervous it's making realtors, right? Because when you get to a situation where a third of homes are currently unaffordable, that while the vast majority do remain affordable, right? But as mortgage rates rise, and affordability will worsen, and buyers need to spend an ever larger share of their homes to buy an increasingly expensive house, those are the beginning of the worrisome trends that we all saw in the years leading up to the housing crash. And you get into this non-traditional home financing and smaller down payments and pressure to move away from urban job centers. And that's how bubbles get formed. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. And let me just say, I'm not saying a bubble has been forming. I think there are some forces at work that are going to keep that down for the moment. But it's really interesting to see who can actually afford to buy a house. Grace joins me on the line all the way from Chicago, my hometown. Hi, Grace.
Hello. I own a condominium. And I noticed some moisture on the pipes in the HVAC unit.
Mm-hmm.
And phoned the maintenance department in the building. And they came up and told me it was just condensation. And all it needed to do, all they needed to do was to wrap it in insulation. I argue with them some because we have two such units in our condo. And we've lived there for over 20 years. We've never noticed any moisture on the pipes. And the other unit, the other HVAC unit in the condominium, had no such moisture. So it seemed odd to me that it was just, I mean, it's the same climate in both places.
Really? You don't have, like, a multiple climate apartment? It does seem a little strange. I mean, most people live in, like, you know, Hawaii and in, say, D.C. at the same time.
So, but what could I do? You know, I mean, I really, you know, he was very insistent, and he wrapped the pipes in insulation. And so I left it at that. In other words, he was very dismissive of my concerns. And then a month or two later, I noticed a puddle of water in front of that unit, and I'm sure you can tell what's happening. Actually, the unit that had been a part in the HVAC that was defective, and it was leaking. A slow leak, but still, it was definitely a leak. So I did, you know, finally maintenance advised me of who I should call, the manufacturer of the unit, to replace that, and I did. I spent, you know, a number of hundreds of dollars to replace that unit. I understand that's my responsibility. But because of the flood, the cover of the HVAC unit was, you know, cosmetically destroyed by being wet. And eventually, you know, the paint started peeling, and I spent some money to replace that. So I would like to know, in other words, the condominium association keeps telling me that I'm responsible for the unit, and that would include the paint damage that was due to the negligence advice that the maintenance people gave me.
So Grace, well, first of all, you have to look. You're renting your unit or you own
it? No, I own the condominium.
You own the condo.
Yes.
So your HVAC unit is your responsibility. And
yes,
in your heart, you knew that when he told you that it was because of the temperature in your unit or the, you know, the humidity in which you were living in that part of the apartment, that you knew that that wasn't right. And what you should have done at the time, because you are responsible, would have been to call a proper guy who actually knew something about HVAC instead of relying on this guy until things got worse. So I think in your heart you knew that that was on you.
Sorry.
You know, you've asked for the advice. You know, my suggestion to you is you know, if you hired a plumber and the plumber came in and gave you bad advice and it caused a bigger piece of damage, then, you know, you would say to yourself, well, can I go back to that plumber? And the answer is typically no. You get, they came, they gave you free advice. You get what you pay for. Typically in a condo, you own everything inside the walls. And you own the, you know, if somebody leaks into your apartment, you may even have to pay for the paint, even though the building might be responsible for where that leak came from. So unless that has changed in some way, no, I think you are responsible for repainting it, and just be really glad that it didn't destroy floors and everything else, because it sounds like it could have been a whole lot worse than it was. And next time I would say trust yourself, because if you know that you're getting bad advice, and you truly did, I would have moved right away to get some different advice. Thank you so much for your call. 404-872-0750. We have to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment with more of the Elise Kling Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time on WSB.
News 95.5 at AM 750 WSB keeps you covered with breaking news, weather, and traffic all weekend. This is Scott Slade. Join us early. Atlanta's morning news begins at 4:30 Monday with traffic updates every 6 minutes of what could be a wet morning drive on WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Kling Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. 404-872-0750. Happy to have you join us today. Sherry joins me on the line with more renovation woes. Hi, Sherry.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. What's going on with you?
Well, to shorten this as much as possible, I renovated a second bathroom that did not have a shower. When I bought the house, I think it was an emotional buy. And the concept,
the shower or the bathroom or the house?
The house.
Okay. Just feeling a little bad, decided to go buy a house. Okay.
Yeah. At any rate, to make the second bath usable, I had to put a shower in. And the contractor, instead of using a plumber, did the work himself. And on a punch list at the end of the time he was renovating, informed him that some of the water, when it was turned on, was refluxing back up into the shower head instead of coming out of the water spout. And also the bathroom water spout was really loose, and it turns out that he had put in PVC instead of sweating a copper pipe or male pipe onto that, so it was more stable. So I hired a few different plumbers. Long story short, I got a very experienced plumber to fix some of the issues. He found some adhesive in one of the pipes, which was the reason that the water was going back up into the shower valve when
it was
the
blocked.
Water was turned on.
Okay.
Yeah. And so fortunately, I was able to get someone who could fix it without opening up my plaster walls or pulling out all that new tile that was put in. But in the process, I ended up spending about over $500 to get this work done. And I'm just wondering if there's any recourse with the contractor, because he saw the punch list. He kind of blew it off. And
well, had you paid the, okay, so had you paid your contractor everything there was to do? Everything?
Oh, yeah. You know, the typical, I need a check today, and I'm such a goof, I should have held out $1,000 until I felt
you should have.
Comfortable.
Mm-hmm. So thank you for sharing that with everybody. You're not the first.
I'm not a doormat either. So let me just say that.
So everybody gets, okay, but this is an area that you're not an experienced person in. My sister and her husband are going through the same thing now, where they hired a designer, they fell in love with the designer, and the designer said, oh, I can be the contractor too. So the 4 to 6 week project is now going to be 12 weeks. And they've had the wrong amount of tile. And my sister's not a doormat, right? She's my sister. But what happens is we get into these situations where it's just, we feel like we've hired the expert, and so we let ourselves take a step back. So, yes, you should have withheld the $1,000. You can go after him in small claims court if you want. That's the only place. And see if you can just sort of do it yourself and get him to pay court costs and the $500. And maybe if you sue him, because it'll be public record, he'll just come forward. I would ask for the money first, and then I would make sure that you don't recommend him to anybody, because that is how bad behavior proliferates. People are like, oh, yeah, you forget how annoying and bad they were, and so you recommend them. If honestly, if my sister recommends this designer to anybody, I'm going to throttle her because this guy has done nothing, in my mind. Beautiful design. Hire him for the design. Then get a contractor who actually knows what they're doing. And contractors who say they can do everything, high on my list. So you're probably going to have to sue in small claims court, Sherry, but I hope it doesn't come to that. Maybe he'll be reasonable. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Sherry, let me know what happens. I'm Elise Glink. Stay tuned. Be back in a moment with more on the Elise Glink Show on WSB.
When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
It's 12:07 on 95 News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB. I'm Elise Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time. Don't forget, taxes are due a week from Tuesday. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. All right, we left some people hanging on. Happy to take your calls. We have a couple of lines open as well. Regina joins me on the line from Maryland. Hi, Regina.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for calling WSB. How can I help you today?
I have a situation. I just moved to Maryland about over a year ago, and I have a townhome in Marietta that the house next door just sold for about $100,000 at the beginning of 2013. And I was going to put it on the market because the home prices started going up in the neighborhood. But then about a month ago, I noticed that there's a pending short sale for about $114,000. And then another house is on the market for $149,000. So I'm wondering if I should just bother, if I should try to still put it on the market, or if I should just hold on for maybe another year to see if the market changes again. I know you don't have a crystal ball, but...
Oh, I do have one. It's just kind of cracked. I would love for it not to be cracked. So you've got a really interesting conundrum, because the short sale that's on the market for $114,000 might actually sell for, let's just say, $100,000. The house next door sold for $100,000. And if I were an appraiser and I was looking at that for a bank, and then you know, don't have any higher sales than that, and your house, you're trying to sell it at $125,000, let's say it's where you get an offer for it, a lender may or may not want to appraise that out. So the real question is, have there been any other sales in the immediate neighborhood that's higher than $100,000?
I'm not sure about that.
So that's the key question you have to answer. You have to talk to a local realtor and say, and you can look on Zillow, but honestly, it's not current. It's not that current. I would probably call some local realtors and just say, this is the address. This is what it looks like. I assume you have photos of it. Do you have people living there right now? Is it rented?
No, it's not rented.
Okay, so it's vacant?
Yes.
A vacant house is harder to sell anyway, and they typically sell for less money than a house that's, you know, fully done up. So there may be some staging costs if you were going to have a realtor come in. But let's just say you have a realtor come in, and they tell you that they think they could probably get $125,000 for it as is.
Mm-hmm.
That is meaningless unless the other numbers in the neighborhood will support that. So you've got to find out what it looks like, the neighborhood really looks like in terms of sales. So,
okay.
And it's not just about next door. You can make a case that up to, you know, not a mile away, but maybe even a quarter of a mile away or half a mile away, that matters. If you're in a, are you in a community, like a subdivision community?
Yes.
So you need to find out what's selling in that community, and if there's a neighboring community, what's selling in that community. And for that, I think you really need some eyes and ears on the ground, because now you live in Maryland, which is terrific, except it's, you know, not so conducive when you're trying to sell a house. And I want you to consider the idea of staging your house, because an empty house looks disproportionate to what actually can fit in it. So most people, I just had this conversation with somebody last week, most people can't visualize. They just don't have the design acuity to walk into a house and say, wow, my stuff's going to look great here. They want to walk into a house that's totally furnished, that looks like HGTV, and then they can sort of do a better mathematical substitution and say, right,
well,
so here's a couch, my couch.
I actually have furniture still there, so I guess that might not be a bad idea. I have most of my furniture still in the home.
Okay. So it's pretty decorated. It looks decorated?
Yes.
Okay. So is it decorated for sale?
It's probably not decorated for sale, no.
Okay. So if you're going to list it, so I think the first thing is to have a conversation with a couple of different real estate agents. Are you coming back to town anytime soon?
I am.
Okay. Before you get to town, I would call some local real estate agents from a couple of different firms that actually sell frequently in your neighborhood.
Okay.
And I would invite these real estate agents to come in and meet you in the house, give them a tour, talk to them about what's going on, and ask them to bring information with you. Typically, comparative marketing analysis is a two-part step. They come see the house, then they go home, they do some research, they come back, and they present their findings. So if you're going to be in town for a while, they could do that. Or you could just ask them to kind of compress it, where they do some research and then they come in, and you have this conversation about what they think your house would be worth as is, if you dressed it for sale, what's actually selling in the neighborhood, can they show you the sales sheets. It doesn't matter what's listed, it really matters what has sold and how recently.
Okay.
So all of that together, I think you're going to get a really good understanding of what you should do. Because if it were me, if they came in and they said, look, Elise, the bad news is all the houses that have sold have been between 100 and 105. There are a couple of houses on the market at $150,000, and I didn't ask you, Regina, but how much do you want for your house?
At least 140, 135, 140.
Okay. So if the house that's on the market for 149 doesn't sell, then, you know, they're going to come in and say to you, the homes that have sold for the highest prices are $105,000, $110,000, and now you've got the short sale on the market for $114,000, but it's really, we've been inside of it, it's really going to go for $89,000. That would be worst case scenario. Ooh. And in that, I would say to you, I made up all those numbers. Don't have a heart attack on the air. It's really bad for other listeners if they think that people call in for advice and I make them have heart attacks. So breathe.
No.
But what I'm saying is that if they can't tell you with any confidence that they can get close to 140, which by the way means listing it like 155, if they can't do that with confidence and prove to you why that'll happen for you, then I think you're going to want to wait another year. And that may mean either having a family member live there or you rent it out for a year, whatever it's going to take to let it go. Because the difference in price is significant between $100,000 and $150,000. Now, if they come back to you and they say, okay, this house is on the market for $149,000, we think it's going to go for $144,000. The short sale is actually taken care of. That's really not going to be counted. It's off the market already. And three other home sales are already pending at $138,000, $142,000, and $149,000. Then I'd say to you, you know, you probably want to get on the market because it's the spring market and get in there while interest rates are still low. Because I started the show last hour talking about affordability. The lower interest rates are, the more people can afford to buy. By the end of this year, 2014, mortgage interest rates are expected to be over 5% for a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. And that means the number of people who can afford to pay $150,000 for your house is much lower. So you're racing time on both ends, which is a terrible position to be in, and I feel for you. And that's why when you come to town, I want you to have conversations with several of these real estate agents so that you can get a sense of what they think is immediately going on in your neighborhood.
Okay. Well, I actually feel better now that I've spoken to you.
Oh, that's good. Like I said, nobody wants to hear you have a heart attack on air. But why do you feel better? Tell me what you're thinking.
Well, because I was on the fence about even listing it now, I thought it would probably not even go for anywhere near 130, 135.
Mm-hmm.
But I just didn't want to waste my time coming down there to speak with a realtor, being disappointed completely.
Okay.
So I need to speak with a professional and make a good decision after that, after they see my home.
Right. And I would talk to them on the phone first, before you even have made your reservation to come in. So don't buy your ticket yet. I would call them on the phone, a couple of these really good people who've worked in your neighborhood, and I would just say to them, you know, assume my house looks like X, right? It's, you know, the carpeting's 5 years old, but I replaced the kitchen. Whatever you do. This is what my house looks like. This is the larger neighborhood. It's very similar to this house at this, you know, thing. Can you drive by? Let's have a conversation about what you think is going on in the area, so I get a sense of whether now is the right time to sell. I will tell you that one of the reasons that buyers told me on the show a couple of weeks ago, when we had people call in and say, why aren't you buying? Their answer in part was, there's nothing good to buy. So there is a shortage of homes for sale right now. And I think there are a lot of people like you who are just trying to decide, if they wait 6 months, is it going to be a better decision or a worse decision? Are you going to get more money, or there's going to be fewer people able to buy? That is such an interesting calculus. And I honestly, in the 20-odd years I've been covering real estate and writing about it, talking about it, I'm not sure we've faced it more than once. And the one time we faced it was way back in the 90s. Before that whole area, that decade of sort of, you know, that there was just a lot of growth in the 90s. But before that started and interest rates were like at 7%, that might have been the last time. And it did pay for people to hold on, but there are costs to holding on that will detract from the actual profit on the other side. And so there's lots of things. Typically, my advice is, when you're done with a property and you've moved on, sell it. Get rid of it. Move on with your new life. You're going to do that. The question is, do you do it today, or you do it in the summer, or you do it in September? And that's why you need more information on a very, very micro local level. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Do you think Regina should sell now, wait it out? What do you think? 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Klink, Rebuilding America, one house at a time on WSB.
Depend on us for breaking news, weather, and traffic updates all weekend. In Atlanta's morning news, listen early for weather and traffic updates every 6 minutes. A heavy cold rain will start the week. And Kirk Mellish's five-day forecast on WSB.
I'm the Elise Klink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours. Stephanie joins me on the line. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Elise.
What's going on?
I live in Smyrna, Georgia, and I own a townhouse that is very, very close to where they are going to put the new Braves Stadium.
So
I am worried about what's going to happen to my property value with the increase of traffic and the stadium and parking, and I don't know if crime is going to go up, crime is going to go down. So I'm just curious to know if you have any ideas about what will happen to my property value because of this new stadium.
You know, Stephanie, I really don't know, because it could, as you point out, could go either way. In Chicago, where I grew up, I literally lived within walking distance of Wrigley Field. So Wrigley Field has been in Chicago, in the north side of Chicago, for 100-plus years. It's now one of the oldest, I think, that and Fenway are the two oldest stadiums in the country. And when I was growing up 30-odd years ago, or 40 years ago, God, I'm so old, when I was growing up, that neighborhood was awful. I mean, really awful. Today, Wrigleyville, which is what it's called, is one of the hottest neighborhoods in Chicago, and home prices there never fell that much compared to the rest of the metro area and have already rebounded then some. And people love living near the ballpark. Yes, there's some crime, and yes, there's a lot of traffic, and boy, is there a lot of congestion. And Bernie Hansen, who was the ward alderman for the 44th Ward, you know, a bazillion years ago, fought having lights put into that stadium forever. But the upshot is that that neighborhood became incredibly valuable. And People have done very well being there. So what will happen with this neighborhood? Because you can't say that any of that good stuff happened with where the Braves have been playing. The big complaint, as I've heard it, is that that neighborhood never really did develop and was crime-ridden and all the rest. My sense, though, is this neighborhood that they're moving into is more developed already. And when something already is there, the tendency tends to be an enhancement. But really, it's what do you want to do? And how do you want to live in that kind of an area? Do you want to live there? And do you worry that if it doesn't go well, because remember, this, you know, it's hard to understand whether it'll go well or not. Even if it's worth more, would you want to live in that neighborhood? And that's a question only you can answer. But as far as whether it will help or hurt, I tend to think they're going to do a better job. I think it's going to help. I think your property price will go up, but it's going to take some time. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Link, 28 minutes past the hour. Rebuilding America, one house at a time on WSB.
News 95.5 at AM 750 WSB keeps you covered with breaking news, weather, and traffic all weekend. This is Scott Slade. Join us early. Atlanta's morning news begins at 4:30 Monday with traffic updates every 6 minutes of what could be a wet morning drive on WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Link Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time on WSB, 404-872-0750. As always, our last half hour is packed with information and calls, so let's dig right in. Emily joins me on the line from Louisville. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Elise. Your screener told me to say, go cats, because both she and I are graduates of the University of Kentucky. So, in honor of your screener, go Cats.
Listen, Crystal is a Kentucky nut, and I say that with all possible love and due respect. So, congratulations on your victory as well yesterday.
Very well. Thank you.
What can I do for you?
I have some quick advice for the gal who can't decide whether or not to sell that house or to hang around for a while, sell it in a year, or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And I would give her a very shocking situation to think of, to get her to move.
Okay.
I would ask her, do you have cancer? And she would go, cancer? What has that got to do with selling my house? I would tell her, if she's in good health, now's the time to sell it, when she can take the hit, be depressed for a couple of months, and move on. But if she ends up waiting a year or two and then gets some bad news in the health department, which is happens more and more as you get older, she's not going to be able to deal with the house at all. So I'd tell her, it's like having your foot stuck in a mud puddle. You're strong enough to pull it out. Pull it out now while it's just your foot and not your whole leg.
So she's not actually thinking about delaying it a year or two. What she's trying to do is figure out if she can wait and should wait until after the short sale goes off the market, because that could actually make a profound difference in a few short months, just getting rid of an underpriced short sale. But I think you make a good point, which is that once you've moved on, and you should try and get rid of property. So what can I do for you?
Okay, I have two questions. One is simple and straightforward. The other one is an interesting situation that my sister had in trying to sell her house. The first question is, what is the current situation on federal flood insurance? I know that they had passed a law. Everyone freaked out. It went back to Congress. They've made some changes. What is the situation, and is it a permanent situation?
So what happened is with the flood insurance, it was the Bigger Waters law, and it got passed and in 2012. And basically what it was going to do was for the 10% or 15% of homeowners who are basically being subsidized by all of us for their flood insurance by building in high-cost areas but not paying high-cost flood insurance, it was going to allow the insurance companies to bring them up to speed in terms of cost. And when the real numbers came in, the realtors freaked out and went to war, and basically it got rescinded. So officially, it's delayed. I just want to point out that the FEMA flood insurance program that everybody screams about is $24 billion in the red after losses from everything relating to Sandy and Katrina and all the others. So for everybody that's always screaming about how the government's in the red and this and that with the government, $24 billion, and fixing it meant raising the flood insurance premiums, but nobody liked that either. So we're at an impasse is where we are, because there's no way that the realtors, which are the strongest housing lobby, strongest lobby in general in Washington, are going to let houses not get sold. And they won't get sold if they don't have flood insurance. And if nobody can afford the premiums, that kills a huge piece of chunk of business. So basically, we're at an impasse, and it technically, officially, it's delayed right now.
Okay, next situation.
All right.
My sister had a house in northern North Carolina, and she got a contract on it. And it was a contingent contract, and the people put down $1,000 worth of earnest money. It turned out that the people didn't really seem interested in buying the house. My sister could never find out anything about how was their house doing, how was it selling. I would say one thing, that I don't think her realtor was really very good. But after, but at the end of the contract, the people apparently had never sold their house, or my sister couldn't find out, and it just went on, and finally the contract elapsed. Well, my sister had kept her house in a contingent sale mode, which is not good, for 5 months, and ended up with absolutely nothing to show for having taken her house off the market for these people. Well, not taken it off the market, but really almost sold the house to these people, and yet it never really came about. I think the people simply were out putting $1,000 here, $1,000 there, and then finally moving on the house they liked the most.
But your sister made like 10 mistakes. Right?
Yes.
So what are you asking me?
Well,
whether she's entitled to keep the $1,000? She might be, but the sellers will probably have to release it. And
yes,
her real estate agent would have to fight for it. And it sounds like her real estate agent's incompetent.
Right.
Completely incompetent. So she's not going to. So your sister, you know, is paying for the mistakes she's made.
The next time, should she consider asking much more earnest money? And
the next time, she should put a limit on the kid. There are 10 things she could do, right? She could ask for much more money for earnest money. She could ask for and demand that that the contingency would expire within a certain period of time. She could say that they can just have a first right of refusal. She's going to continue to market the house for sale.
Mm-hmm.
If she could get a real estate agent who's got some, you know, guts to them, to him or her, and actually goes out and does active marketing and finds out what's going on with the other person's property, deals with that agent and all the rest. She can ask for updates from the buyers. And, you know, there's just a lot of things that she could do.
Yes, and my personal opinion was that her real estate was either incompetent or not working at arm's length with the
people. She was, but it's your sister's fault. Yeah, absolutely. But it's your sister's fault for not going after that realtor and asking the managing broker to get on that realtor's case and being on top of it. And instead, she's laying back and waiting for everybody to do things for her. And you know what? When you have a huge asset, you have to go after it. You have to be the one who's doing everything. And even though she hired this real estate agent, the minute she saw that agent wasn't really fighting for her, she should have fired her or gone to the managing broker and asked for to be transferred to a real estate agent who actually knew what they were doing. And she didn't do that either. So when I look at, like, you know, oh, whose fault is it? It's easy to blame the real estate agent. And it may, in fact, be the agent's fault, but your sister hired the agent.
Yes.
Your sister has to drive her sale. Just
yes.
Like you have to drive your purchase. And I have to drive mine. Purchases or sales are big assets. And if you're not going to have the wherewithal to care enough to push the process forward, then you're probably, you know, going to get what you get. And that's why, in a lot of cases, people just have a mediocre or a very poor experience. In my mind, you have to drive it. Your sister had to drive it. And, yeah, she's entitled to $1,000, but she's lost 5 or 7 months of her life and may have missed a window of opportunity in selling the house. And there's nobody to blame but herself. 404-872-0750. Dottie joins me on the line. Hi, Dottie.
Hi.
What's going on?
Hi. I live in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
My husband and I live in a townhouse that was purchased about 35 years ago. It's about 35 years old. When he originally purchased the house, he bought it with his brother. His brother's name and his name were on the house. His brother, a short time later, got married, moved out, and has never had anything to do with the house since then. But my name has never been put on the house, and his name has never been taken off.
Right. So if your husband died, the brother would become your partner.
Yes, that was my concern because we're both retired, we're in our 60s, and I've been trying to find out what the best thing would be to do in case something would happen to my husband. I was told by a lawyer that it was a pretty easy process to put my name on. The house is paid for, by the way.
It's not about you putting your name on as much as it is your brother-in-law taking his name off. And he needs to do a quit claim deed, quit claiming his share of the house to his brother, which, by the way, could engender a tax situation.
Well, that's what I was told, and I didn't really understand that.
So let me explain it to you. It might be
very expensive to do that.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh,
so
boy.
The reason is, so I'm sure he bought the house for, let's say, $10,000. What is the house worth today?
He bought it for about $48,000, and it's worth, I'd say, in the low 200s.
Okay. So let's just make life easy and say they bought it for $50,000, and now the house is worth $200,000. Okay? So that's $150,000 worth of gain. The brother paid, let's say, $25,000 for his share, and his share is now worth $100,000. So there's been a fourfold increase. If he quit claims the property to his brother, it's like he's giving his brother a gift at $100,000.
Okay. In other words, is that called gifting?
It's basically what it is a gift.
Okay.
Now, you're allowed to give away $5 million, so it's unlikely that the brother is ever going to run into this issue, but it could trigger a taxable event. Your brother-in-law could leave the house to his brother or to you and his brother's heirs, but if your husband dies first, that could change. So really the best thing for him to do is to do a quick claim deed over to his brother, who would then own the house, and then your husband can do a quick claim deed into the name of you and your husband, joint ownership with rights of survivorship. You need a real estate attorney to be able to help you with that, and
right.
You should definitely hire one, and you guys should get moving on it. Now, the question is your brother-in-law willing to do that?
Yes.
Well, then
in fact, he said he really doesn't want the responsibility of dealing with it because he has some health issues and personal problems in his life. And he said, I have enough troubles. I really don't want to have that responsibility, too.
Great. So you need to tomorrow find a great real estate attorney who can help you draw up a quit claim deed and get it filed, notarized and filed appropriately for wherever the house is. I assume it's in Maryland where you live. And make sure all of that happens, and you can do it in a week.
Okay. But as far as the tax goes, that's probably pretty sure we might have to pay, like,
nope.
$10,000 in taxes?
No. I didn't say it could cause a taxable event, but it would be the gifter who pays it, the brother-in-law. But Dottie, you got to just take a breath. Just let me finish my sentence. You know, I'm just giving people heart attacks on the show today, and I don't mean to. It's a possible tax event, but it probably will mean nothing because you're allowed to give, like I said earlier, over $5 million away. So this just gets banked in the total amount that your brother-in-law is allowed to give away in his lifetime.
Okay.
So I don't believe he will have to pay anything on it, and you won't have to pay anything on it.
Oh.
So it should be fine, but I want you to work with a really good real estate attorney who understands this and make sure that he walks you through it and shows you how the numbers work so that you and your brother-in-law and your husband are all comfortable that you understand how the numbers work. But don't have a heart attack over this. Nobody's going to have to write a check to the IRS, and instead it's just going to make everybody sleep better at night. All right? I'm Elise Link. Stay tuned. Be back in a moment with a prize pack and more on Rebuilding America One House at a Time on WSB.
Depend on us for breaking news, weather, and traffic updates all weekend. At Atlanta's Morning News, listen early for weather and traffic updates every 6 minutes. A heavy, cold rain will start the week. And Kirk Mellish's 5-day forecast on WSB.
Hey, we've got a quick prize pack to give away. It includes 4 tickets to see the Braves on April 13th at Turner Field, a $25 McDonald's gift card, and a $25 Lakewood 400 Antiques Market gift certificate. We'll give it away to the fifth caller at 404-741-0750. Good luck with that. This is the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time on WSB. Chris joins me on the line. So, Chris, you called in about our townhouse owner in Marietta. And
yeah.
I understand you think that I missed a couple of points. What did I miss?
Well, I don't know if you missed it, but first and foremost, I would ask her if the HOA will even allow her to rent it out, if that's an option or if they're kept out at this point. Secondly, what is the HOA monthly fee? If she can't rent it, of course, then she could be paying a note plus that each month. Thirdly, it just in Atlanta alone, 74% of the houses sold, or I'm sorry, nationally, 74% of the homes sold were to investors last month. Our market currently is up 10 to 15%, but that's due to hedge fund and false manipulation of the market and the lack of REO properties. My recommendation to her, since she did go to Maryland, if it was a job transfer, she would require a hardship and possibly do a short sale and take advantage of what the banks are offering now with cash for keys and hopefully $2,000.
Chris, take a breath, because she didn't say she was underwater.
I didn't catch that.
She didn't say she's underwater, and we did talk a little bit about, you know, what are the monthly fees. But the point you've made, which is a good one, and that's one of the ones that I talked to her about as well, is when you have all of the costs of carry, so your mortgage, your taxes, your insurance, any HOA fee that you might have, all of those go together. And, you know, gardening costs, expenses, all of that carrying cost will eat away at any kind of pop you might get, unless it's a really significant pop in price. So the reason that she was calling is because once the short sale goes off the market, there's already a house on the market for $50,000 more, right, or about $45,000 more. So if the short sale goes away and if the 149 house sells, it's totally worth it for her to wait 3 to 6 months to sell, because no matter what her monthly carrying costs are, it won't equal that. But over the big picture, I completely agree. All of that has to be factored in so that you know whether or not you're going to make money. And for a lot of people, they think there's going to be this huge pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and they wait and they wait and they wait. And in effect, they end up at zero or less than zero. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time on WSB. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'll be back next week for another edition of the show. I hope you'll join me then. Find me online, thinkglink.com. 10,000 pages of free information on buying, selling, fixing up, and financing your houses. And don't forget to check out the Equifax Finance blog for information on the six pillars of personal finance. Have a great week, everybody. See you Sunday.